Well, good morning to everyone. It's so good to see you this morning. I'm going to have to ask you to use your imagination this morning. I have a PowerPoint presentation in front of me, and I'm just going to describe it to you as I click through.
All right.
Well, that's not going to work that way.
Old school.
Yeah. So, but it is, there's quite a bit of like photographs and pictures that I was going to show to you. Well, life has a funny way of just changing your plans, but that's okay. That's okay. So we'll work with this. But we're going to be talking about today, again, talking about the idea of how we got our Bibles. This has been a series of lessons that we've been talking about through the last several months. We talked about the idea of the inspiration. How is it that we got our Bibles? Well, first we got it through inspiration. God gave words to prophets. Gave words to apostles, and those words were inspired. Do I understand everything about that inspiration process? Of course not. It's why you call it a miracle. It was by God's providence that he gave these words to these individuals, and now we have them in our hands. But it's not just that we have the Apostle Paul speaking here among us. He wrote these things down. And then individuals who cared about these words took these words and copied them and made copies of copies of copies. And finally, what we're talking about there is the transmission of the scriptures over thousands of years. Can we trust the Bible? Can we trust how it has been transmitted to us over the years? So we talked about this. We had a few lessons talking about the idea of the manuscripts that we have currently and the evidence that we can say yes of it. The transmission process is something that we can trust. Are there questions that we have about the transmission process? Are there places where we may have questions about certain passages? Well, yeah, absolutely. But we have faith that the Lord has preserved his word throughout the years. We also talked about the canonization. That's the process of taking and collecting all of these inspired books. Sometimes there are questions about the canonization process. Do we have all of the books that we that the Bible that God wants us to have? There are other books running around out there, and sometimes there are questions. Should I use the Bible that the Catholics use, for example? They have several books added to their Old Testament. Should we use those books? Do our Bibles lack something? And we looked at that and had some observations about why is it that Jesus used the Old Testament of the Jews, and that's the Old Testament that we use in our Bibles today as well. There were a couple comments after the sermon last week about the Apocrypha, not of the Old Testament, but the Apocrypha of the New Testament. And there's so much that we could say about that, but Noah's talking about some of the hidden gospels, for example, the gospel of Mary and the gospel of Thomas and the gospel. It seems like everybody has a gospel. But these are gospels that are not written by, gospel of Thomas, for example, is not written by Thomas the apostle. It's written in his name. Or gospel of Mary, it's not written by, Mary herself. It's just something written and then her name is slapped onto it several, but they're written several centuries after the fact. But these are some interesting documents that began to be published in the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th century that are really just interesting. And sometimes people have questions about, well, are these things that we need to have in our Bibles today? And there's an air of secrecy among all of this. Here are these hidden gospels that you don't have in your... Somebody's hiding them from you. And there's some kind of secret. And so... What are people hiding from me? If you have any questions about these hidden gospels, just go read them. And you'll see why they are not in your New Testament. I was reading the Gospel of Thomas yesterday. And it is entertaining. I'll give you that. It is absolutely entertaining. There's at one point, Gospel of Thomas is fragments of a gospel where this Thomas evidently got hold of these documents about Jesus's childhood. Do you know about Jesus's childhood? Oh yeah, we have snippets in the book of Luke about him coming back when he was 12, and we have things about his birth. But what happened in between? What about? Oh, well, you don't know about that, do you? Well, let me fill you in. That's how this works, right? And so the Gospel of Thomas purports to be these documents that have been hidden, and now I'm gonna fill you in on these documents. But these documents then talk about Jesus, who on one occasion he is in the marketplace, and someone comes up and bumps into him, another child bumps into him, and Jesus just gets so angry, he curses that young boy and kills him on the spot. Wow, that's pretty surprising. And so all of the village comes together and says, why do you let this boy do this, cursing people like he is doing? And so Joseph has to calm Jesus down about this. And so Jesus says, well, I know that, you know, Joseph, you don't understand who I am, but these individuals who are doubting me, they are going to go to eternal punishment. And just to be sure, he strikes them all blind. This is not the Jesus that I read about in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. All that to say is that if you read more and more of these Gospels, they have a lot of ideas about Gnosticism, have a lot of ideas about it's another Jesus. And they are entertaining to read, but they are not worth our time. And definitely they do not have the same Jesus that we read about in our Bibles. But there's one more step. That was talking about just these extra books, the canonization process. There's another step, though, that I'd like to talk about and try to finalize our series today, talking about the translation of the Scriptures. I think we all get the idea there. It's going from one language. Translation is transfer of ideas from one language to another language. And I don't think I have to convince you that is a process that we absolutely need. It's a necessary process. I don't read Hebrew. I read a little bit of Greek, and I can use a dictionary, but really, in reality, I don't read Greek. The Bible was written in Hebrew, it was written in Aramaic, it was written in Greek, and so therefore, I need someone to take these words that I'm not familiar with, and these squiggles on a page that I don't understand, and transfer them over to my language. That's what is the translation of the Scriptures. If it were not that case, what would we have to do to know Jesus? Well, we would all have to start learning Hebrew. You don't know Hebrew? Well, we got to start learning. And not just Hebrew, but we got to learn Aramaic from the Old Testament, because Daniel, parts of Daniel and parts of Ezra are written in Aramaic. And then also, you'd have to learn Greek. Not modern Greek, but this old style of Greek, this Koine Greek that was used in the first century. That's going to be a lot of work. We better get started. I'm going to have to start a whole school here about just original languages. That's not going to work. I think it's reasonable to state it's reasonable that we have translations of these documents. But it's interesting that some religions avoid translations altogether. If you're familiar with Islam, for example, true Muslims, devout Muslims will tell you, no. The Quran, for example, should not be translated from Arabic into other languages. And why is that? The reason is because they know that when you go from one language to another, you're opening yourself up to some dangers. We'll talk about some of those dangers later on that I think we can probably understand and appreciate. But I think it's interesting just from the very beginning to understand that God intends for his words to be translated. God himself intends for his words to be translated. I mean, the Scripture is revealed not just in one language. It's three different languages, implying that God's words are not bound to one tongue, but rather they are to be shared in every tongue. In fact, it is interesting, and this is where it's useful to have a slide up here, to see that in the New Testament, many times when the New Testament authors quote passages from the Old Testament, they don't quote it directly from the Hebrew Old Testament. They're speaking to Greeks. And so rather than quoting from a Hebrew document, they quote from a Greek document. Right, that just makes sense. You know, if I'm going to quote something to you, I'm going to read you a passage and I start reading it in Spanish. Well, that's not going to help most of you. Some of you, you can understand it. That's not going to help you. It would be more helpful than to have it in your own language. And so the apostles, when they are quoting from the Old Testament, many times they will quote from not just the Hebrew, but they'll quote from the Old Testament in Greek, which is the Septuagint. There's one case that I think is just really interesting, and really to appreciate this this well, you have to have it in front of you. But in Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 6, it's just one example. We could go to several different examples. But Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 6, when the writer of Hebrews is talking about the nature of Jesus and who Jesus is, he says, Jesus is not some angel. Jesus is not like the angels. He is far superior than the angels. For example, he says in chapter 1 and verse 6, when he again brings the firstborn into the world, he says, and let all the angels of God worship him. And of the angels, he said, he who makes his angels winds and his ministers flaming fire, but of the Son, your throne, O God, is forever and ever, and the scepter of uprightness is the scepter of your kingdom. And so it continues on to talk about the nature of Jesus and how Jesus in his nature is superior than even the angels. What is interesting then is on several occasions in this text, he's quoting particularly from the Septuagint, the Greek version of the Old Testament. In fact, in verse 6 is probably one of the most blatant ones. Because in verse 6, if you go back to the Old Testament to find this quotation, and let all the angels of God worship before him, there are some passages that your New Testament might throw you to, say in Psalm 97 and verse 7. But if you go back to that, it's not exactly what it says here. In fact, the text that is more like this text is in Deuteronomy chapter 32. Deuteronomy chapter 32 and verse 43. It's a text where Moses is singing before God, and in verse 43, he says, O nations, cause his people to shout for joy. This is Deuteronomy chapter 32 and verse 43. O nations, cause his people to shout for joy. For he will avenge the blood of his slaves, and he will render vengeance on his adversaries, and he will atone for his land and his people. Did I get the wrong verse? Maybe I'm supposed to go a verse above or a verse? No, this is the verse that he is quoting from. This verse has exactly the Greek that is in our New Testament, but it's not in the Masoretic text. So our New Old Testaments come from the Hebrew Masoretic text, and that's what they're translated from. But the Greek Old Testament has some additional lines, and this text specifically mirrors with great exactness what the writer of Hebrews is saying in Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 6, saying that the angels also need to worship him. If you have any questions about any of these, I'll be glad to cover them more or sit down with you at some other point. But these are all of this to say that the translation of Scripture, not only is it necessary, but it's also something that God intends to be translated. What's important to see is that if the apostles are quoting from not just the Hebrew text, but they're quoting from the Greek text, that then is a stamp of approval by the apostles themselves on not just this text that they're quoting, but also the idea of translation from one language to another. There's another idea that I want to spend just a few moments on, and it's the idea of Jesus' own words being translated. It's interesting to think that even Jesus' words, the majority of the words that we have in the New Testament, not only are they translated into English for us, but they were first translated from his language, which was like Aramaic or Hebrew, into Greek. For example, we can have in Mark chapter 5, there are several passages across the Gospels that retain some of the language of Jesus himself. Mark is famous for doing this, where he retains just some of the actions of Jesus, some of the personality of Jesus. In Mark's gospel, it's like you were there with Jesus. And so, for example, in Mark chapter 5 and in verse 41, when he heals this this child, he says in verse 41, now taking the child by the hand, he said to her, "Talitha cum," which translated means, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." Now, wait a minute. If you're going to translate it, why don't you translate even the Talitha? What is Talitha cum? Where does that come from? Is that Greek? That is what Jesus evidently said. Those are his words then, coming from Aramaic. But then for Mark's audience, Mark needed those words translated. Not only these words, but all of Jesus' words translated for them. So all that to say then that when the gospel writers are writing these documents, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, in Greek, not only are they translating some of the quotations from the Old Testament, but also they are translating Jesus' words. That's important to see then, that this is the apostles' stamp of approval on the translation process. In other words, we can, as John chapter 20 says, in John chapter 20, at the end of John chapter 20, there is this final note for us, that even though there is so much translation being practiced in these documents, John finishes up and says what? He says in John chapter 20 and verse 30, "Therefore many other signs Jesus also did in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these which have been written, these have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name." That is to say that these documents, even though there has been some translation going on of Jesus' words, even though Jesus did not speak to his disciples in Greek directly, now we can read these words of Jesus. We can read his miracles, and we can have salvation. Salvation, even though there has been translation. I think that's an important idea. That's an important idea to see that God intends for his words to be translated. But that is not to say that translation is not without difficulty. That translation by itself has challenges, and that's why some religions say, well, no, you're not going to translate our sacred scriptures. Translation has some very difficult challenges. Just for example, even in English, if I wanted to say something, I could say it in how many different ways? It's hot today. It's burning up. You get the idea. The temperature's rising. All of those can communicate the same idea, but in several different angles. The same is true when you take then one idea from one language to another. And so that you can translate in so many different ways. What does that require then? That requires a decision on the part of the translator for which avenue am I going to go. That's going to require, I'll just give you an idea, when I'm translating from English into Spanish or Spanish into English, a lot of times the way that I choose is not so much, okay, you know what, this is the word that is the most appropriate for this setting, it's the perfect word. I choose the words that I know. And sometimes when I'm translating, I'll choose words, no. I'll choose a whole phrase in order to describe it because I don't know the word for it. And so a translator then has these steps here that if he's translating on the fly or doing something quick, does he get the meaning across? You get the meaning across. Several of you are bilingual. You know this process. You get the meaning across. But translation has its inherent challenges for understanding, is this the exact meaning or not? Does that make sense? And incluso, I'm thinking in Spanish now. There are some things in certain languages that are just interesting about those languages. Certain characteristics of those languages that you don't find in other languages. For example, in Greek, nouns have gender. by themselves. And so we have this a little bit in English. For a while, at least, hurricanes were always what? We're always female. Well, the females have complained about that, and so now we have equal representation. Boats, for the longest time, were what? They're all female, right? A ship is going to be a female for whatever reason, right? Well, same thing is true in Spanish. You go, why is this particular noun? Why is it a male or a female? In Spanish, you have female and male nouns. Why? I don't know. I don't know who decided that, but somebody decided, and now this is the way it is. Well, in Greek, it's the same way. You have male nouns, you have female nouns, and you even have neuter nouns. Just nouns right in between, or nouns that just don't have. And that's weird. That's weird to think about. But then when you translate, then, Greek into English, what do you have to do? Well, we don't have any way to represent that. We could put like a little F, you know, behind the word in English. We could have little helps to remind us that this was a, but in reality, it doesn't help us at all. And so in our versions, it doesn't really make a difference. But that's just interesting that we have things then, these ideas in a language that once you translate it over to another language, it just completely disappears. In fact, if you take that language, that same language where you have male and female and neuter ideas, and you send it over to another language, say Spanish, that does have some of those male and female ideas, it's interesting that some of those are assigned differently in another language. And so it doesn't help you there either. Wow. There's a challenge there, isn't there? Another thing that's interesting is the word you. The word you. What does you mean? In English, well, I'm you. I say, yeah. Well, how did you know that I was saying you plural? You know, in English, if we want to say you to everybody, you have to go all the way down to Texas to say y'all, right? Or you all. That's not a construction that is grammatically correct here in the North. But that's just part of the language in other languages. In Spanish, you have tú, usted, vos, ustedes, vosotros, and there may be some other ones that I'm forgetting. There are five different ways that I can say you. And so if I'm going to translate from one language to another, what do I choose? First of all that information, all that good information that's there, what happens to it? It just disappears. It disappears when we bring it over to English. It's interesting. Look with me in your Bibles in the book of Luke. Look with me in Luke chapter 22, and this is just one of those interesting things about the word "you" that sometimes in English we don't really appreciate. But if you could see the Greek and see that it's there, then it would help you to appreciate something that Jesus is saying here. So, for example, in Luke chapter 22 and verse 31. Here is Jesus speaking to Simon. He says, "Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has demanded to sift you like wheat. But I have prayed earnestly for you that your faith may not fail. And you, once you have returned, strengthen your brothers." What's interesting about this is that there is a change here in the plurality of yous. For example, in verse 31, "Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has demanded to sift you." That "you" is not just Simon, but it's all of the disciples. Sift you. It's a plural "you" here. But then he says specifically to Simon, "But I have prayed earnestly for you." That's pretty amazing. He's praying for Simon particularly, that your faith may not fail. And that you, once you have returned, strengthen your brothers. All of those other yous then are going to be a singular idea. But here we have these ideas in the Greek, a plural you and then a singular you. Once you take them over to English, we kind of lose that. Okay, well, we have tools. And we can look things up. but it is something that when you are translating from one language to another, you lose something a lot of times. So not only do you lose something, but sometimes even when you go from one language to another, you have to add things. For, I was talking about the five different ways you can say you in Spanish. Why do you have five ways to say you? Well, it's not just about singular and plural. It's about informal and formal. So I can say you, and if I'm talking to Lord Huntley, and I speak with great respect to Huntley because he's older than I am, then I have to use one you. That would be usted. But if I speak to Amos, we can talk. I can speak informally with Amos, right? Because he's younger than I am. So I can use the word tú. Well, that depends on where I am. If I do it in Mexico, it's one kind of tú. If I do it in Spain, it's a different type of you. It's confusing, by the way. All that to say, though, Greek doesn't have any of that formal or informal tú. So now, when I go from Greek into Spanish, I have to make a decision. I have to add something that is not there before. Is this going to be a formal you this time? Or is this going to be an informal you? In some versions, it is different from version to version, which is confusing, which adds then to some of our doubt. Can I really trust this translation process? Besides that, then, there are also things that we need to understand that when you go from one language to another, there are a lot of phrases that just don't translate. How would you translate? Maybe you don't know another language, but I think you can understand this. How would you translate the phrase, "It is raining like cats and dogs"? Could you imagine what people think in another language if you just say, "It's raining cats and dogs"? What kind of weather do they have? This is worse than global warming. What is going on there in the United States? Raining cats and dogs. I'm assuming you have that phrase there in the Virgin Islands as well. It rains more there, right?
They also have male hurricanes.
Okay, male hurricanes. Right there, okay. But you can understand how that's going to be difficult. I have a choice as a translator now. I can translate this to be understandable, and so I say in Spanish, and it's what I'm more comfortable with. Ah, está lloviendo recios. What does that mean? That means it's strongly raining. Okay, that's what we mean if I say it's raining cats and dogs, right? It's really raining. Está lloviendo recios. Okay, we get that. But what do you lose there? You lose a little bit of the flavor of the language, don't you? As you have to make those compromises sometimes when you're translating. Sometimes it happens. And so if I translate, sometimes I'll say, está lloviendo recios. It's strongly, it doesn't sound right in English either. It is raining really hard. But then I fill people in. You know what I really said? You know what he really said? Let me tell you about this idiom. And people will say that idiom and go, whoa, that's really interesting. You have a choice. Either you translate something very literally, or you translate something in a very understandable way. If you translate it in one, let me say this, if one is not better than the other. One is not better than the other in this sense. If you translate something literal, that is helpful because it brings people into the world of the text. It brings people in to start to understand that English idiom like they have not before. Translate something in an understandable way, it brings that text then to the life of the individual. It helps them to understand that in their world. Which one is right? Both of them are right. Does that make sense? But those are decisions that you make as you're translating, and those are challenging. Let me give you just an example of this in 1 Peter chapter 1. And we could look at so many different examples, but 1 Peter chapter 1 and in verse 13. 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 13, this is one of my favorite examples of this, but he says, Therefore, preparing your minds for action and being sober-minded, set your hope fully on the grace that will be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. that first portion talks about preparing your minds for action. You may have in your Bible a note in the margin of your Bible that says, literally, what? It's not just preparing your minds for battle, preparing your minds for action. Yeah, that's the idea. That's a very understandable way. But if you want to literally translate this, it's gird up the loins of your mind. Okay, that's a weird idea. But I think we get it. I think we get the idea. Because we have so often then in the scriptures times where they gird up their loins before they're about to do something. Or they say, gird up your loins. We need to do something. We're going to have a fight. We're going to get to work. And here is a very powerful image, I think. Girding up the loins of your mind. I didn't know my mind had loins, but now you know. Girding up its loins, preparing your minds for battle, preparing your minds for work. All that to say is that there are certain phrases, there are certain words that in one language, when you go over, there is something, to use the phrase, lost in translation, right? There's a lot of things that are lost in translation. And so there are challenges when you look at the process of translation. But besides the process of translation being challenging as it is, you also have the fact that translators, well, they make mistakes. I can't tell you how many times when translating from one language to another in Spanish do I make mistakes. And then the whole audience just erupts laughing. Says, what did I say? What did I... Well, it happens. And you know what? That happens as well when people are trying to translate the Bible. There's one example that I have on a slide, and this is not necessarily a translation issue, but it is something about a printing issue. In 1631, the King James had been out for many years. The King James came out in the year 1611. And so what is that? That's 20 years later, they come out with another printing. And in the Ten Commandments, the first line says, verse 13 says, this is Exodus chapter 13, verse 13, it says, thou shalt not kill. Are we good? Yeah, that's what we expected, right?
So we memorized it.
Right. Verse 14, thou shalt commit adultery. Oops. That was a big oops, and that was a big printing. This guy not only got fired, he got fined and got thrown into debtor's prison who did the printing of this. It ended up being a very well-known Bible called the Adultery Bible or the Wicked Bible because it's encouraging people to commit adultery. Okay, that's kind of a humorous, not for the guy who got thrown into jail, but kind of a humorous for us just thinking, wow, that those things can happen. But wait a minute. Could it happen in my Bible? Could that happen that a translator or a publisher does something to make a mistake in my Bible that causes maybe some doubt? In fact, the other day, and I don't remember where it was, but there was an occasion where my family, we were sitting around, and you know the idea of capitalizing Lord in the Old Testament in order to say that this is the name Yahweh, the God's name. We had several editions of the same version. In one version, it was capitalized. In the other version, it was not. And that just blew me away. Here are these, you would think that these would be standardized by now, right? But there are still errors that make their way around. There are errors of carelessness. But there's also errors of ignorance. Errors of ignorance. For example, in Job chapter 39, you can turn there if you want, but I can just tell you what it is right now. Job chapter 39, verses 9 through 10 says, will the unicorn be willing to serve thee or abide by thy crib? Canst thou bid the unicorn with his band in the furrow? Or will he harrow the valleys after thee? Unicorns. Is that what yours says? Probably yours says something about a wild ox. But in the King James Version, still even the King James Versions that we have today, if they go all the way back to 1611 and that text that was translated back then, it says unicorn. Every time this Hebrew word is used in the Old Testament, instead of wild ox, it says unicorn, which is interesting. The King James is not the only Bible to use this translation. The Tyndale Bible before it, which the King James Bible piggybacked on, the Wycliffe Bible, even the Latin Vulgate, the Septuagint, all had this idea of a unicorn. So, unicorns? Why a unicorn? Now, what happens is, a lot of times, the translators in the 17th century don't have a full understanding of what these Hebrew words really mean, because they're only used here in these contexts. And so there are several things that you can do in those contexts. Is number one, you look at, okay, how is it used in other places in the Bible? Look at those contexts and try to fill something in. And then if you can't figure it that way, go look at other translations of this in other languages. And maybe that will fill you in. And so following all of these steps, the King James translators then continued using this word, the unicorn. In fact, in 1657, a Bible commentator named John Trapp stated regarding Job 39, verse 9, "This is the unicorn, a very fierce and strong creature it is, and nowadays very rare, but anciently more common," he thinks. All that to say, there aren't really any unicorns in the Bible. It's better translated as wild ox, and that's what you have here. But here is a case where then a translator, because of really his ignorance of exactly what this word meant, then translates it as unicorn. That gives us a little bit of doubt then. Could that happen on other occasions? There's also then translation errors because of theology. I don't have the text in front of me on the screen, but I think I can read it to you, and many of you know how translations can go awry when someone has in their minds a certain theology that is really not biblical. John chapter 1 and verse 1 is a good example of this, where in John chapter 1 and verse 1, Jehovah's Witnesses have a special translation that only they use. And in John chapter 1 and verse 1, instead of saying that Jesus is God, it says as follows. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was a God. What you have there is that this institution, the Watchtower Society, has from the very beginning this doctrine of, well, Jesus is not God. He is rather just an angel. He's Michael the Archangel, and a very special individual, but he's not God by his nature. And so what they have done in this particular text is redefined the rules and created then a different version, a different verse here that says instead of being God, Jesus is a God. Well, that's one translation. I would say stay away from that translation. But what about our translations? Has that happened in our translations? All of these then, knowing, first of all, going back to our original discussion, translation is necessary. We cannot live without translations. We cannot know God well without translations, or at least without learning those original languages. But then God intends for his words to be translated. But those translations then have challenges that we need to respect, and we need to say, okay, well, there are challenges there, but what can we do to avoid some of this confusion? How can we then know exactly what is said and what is not said? And I think that's where multiple translations and multiple versions really becomes a blessing rather than a curse. So often people come and think about Christianity, and they see all of these different versions. You have the ESV, you have the NASB, the New King James, the NIV. Well, you could name a whole host of different translations, and they say, I don't know. I can't trust that Bible. Look how many translations there are. Really, I think not understanding what translation is all about. Multiple translations, rather than being a curse, it is actually a blessing. Why is that? Because instead of just trusting in one translation, and this being my only translation that I'll ever confide in, I have the opportunity on my phone to be looking up another 100 translations to see, well, how do they translate it in over there? I constantly see Edward doing this. Because he's looking at it in Chinese, he's looking at it in English, he's looking at it in so many different languages. I'm sure that other people who are bilingual have seen the same thing. It looks differently in different languages. That is not a curse. It can be confusing, absolutely, but it absolutely becomes a blessing because it gives us an opportunity to look for more information and to know with greater precision what is the text behind the text. What is the meaning behind my English? And it is so very helpful. Let me say that there is no perfect translation. No matter which way you go, there is no perfect translation. But we absolutely need translations, and we need new translations. We need new translations every generation. The reason is because old English doesn't look like our English anymore. Go back and try to read Shakespeare, right? No, don't try to read Shakespeare in the fonts that we have. Go back and look at the original fonts, and you look at them, and I can't even read that. I was going to try to present like the Wycliffe Bible in front of us. The Wycliffe Bible was the first translation of the Bible completely in English. It wasn't translated from Greek or Hebrew. It was translated from the Latin Vulgate, but it was the first English Bible in the 1300s. But if you were to try to read it, you might get through a couple words, but eventually you say, I have no idea what, I don't even know where I am. I can even tell you, this is the first page of Mark, but it's just confusing because of the font. As generations change, fonts change, language changes, and what was groovy back then is no longer so cool, right? You get what I'm saying? Yeah. I don't know what Shakespeare would say, right? But we get the point. Every generation changes its dialect, and new translations are needed, and they become actually beneficial. There's also benefits in translations also because of textual discoveries. Specifically, when the King James was written, for example, in 1611, when finally it was processed and printed, and there it was in the hands of everybody. Let me say it this way. We have what we said earlier, talking about the transmission of the text. One of the reasons that we can trust that what we have in our hands, yes, is the Word of God, and it can give us some more confidence is by knowing that we have so many manuscripts available to us as witnesses of the original text. And we have witnesses, those manuscripts, that even come from the first century and the second century and the third century. They're very, very old, in other words. When the King James was translated in 1611, those 5,800 manuscripts that we have today were not available to them. And those old manuscripts that we have available today were not available to them either. In fact, the publishers or the translators of the King James generally had a little over a dozen Greek manuscripts available to them at the time. I don't know every single one of the Greek manuscripts and which ones they were using, but it wasn't a large number. It was a very small percentage of Greek manuscripts. And some of the King James, instead of coming directly from Greek, some of that King James comes directly from work from the Latin Vulgate. And so in other words, it goes from Greek a long time ago, then to the Latin Vulgate, and then to translated into English. All that to say, the King James is an amazing, amazing work of progress. Amazing in what the translators did trying to take all of these, the material that was available, and to make something that was beautiful and unique, and it's been the a standard for centuries. But the fact is that the King James is based on the manuscripts, a very few manuscripts, and manuscripts that are from late centuries. Since 1611, there have been many manuscripts that have been discovered, and so that it is only reasonable then that when we look at our modern Bibles, instead of using the same textual base that the King James uses, the modern most modern translations then will go back and take into consideration a lot of those modern discoveries. I hope that is understandable, and again, if anyone has questions about any of these points, I'll be glad to talk more about some of these ideas and discuss them more. There's also something that I wanted to hit on. This goes back to the idea of cats and dogs versus it's raining a lot. But the idea of a literal versus readable. We have so many different translations, and that is a blessing rather than a curse. The fact is that there are translations that are very literal. The New American Standard, for example, is a very literal translation. It's a cats and dogs translation, if you get what I'm saying. The ESV is a very literal translation. But then once you start getting over to the NIV, for example, it becomes less literal. It's not to say that that's necessarily a good thing or a bad thing, but rather, one tries to serve to teach you some, what is that Greek world? How is it that they think about some of these ideas? And they will tell you, it's cats and dogs. You know what I prefer? When I'm reading the Bible and I'm studying the Bible, I prefer a cats and dogs translation. I prefer a more literal translation like the New American Standard or the ESV. I prefer one of those translations. But sometimes when I look at these texts and I say, I'm having a hard time making heads or tails over what this is saying, it's very useful to go to another translation, say the NIV, or another translation that's even more of a paraphrase to say, give me an idea of what this is saying. And it helps to bring light to some of those ideas. Use a more literal translation, mostly. Use the other ones more as a commentary, as something to help illustrate what is going on in the text. But the blessing is that we have all of those options. We have so many options at our disposal. Just thinking about the amount of material and the amount of tools that we have to study the Bible, it is just mind-boggling. It's almost too much that's out there. Where do I start? There's so much material out there. Do you know what the sad thing is? I just don't study my Bible. So we don't take time to even read the Bible. There's so much helps out there. So many translations out there. What is the best translation? Then, in the end, it's the translation that you actually read. Don't worry about if it's the worst translation or it's the best translation. Which one is the best? Just read it. Just enjoy it. Know Jesus through its pages. I want to read one more time from John chapter 20. John chapter 20 and verse 30 and 31. The idea here in John chapter 20, verses 30 and 31, is really just very, very profound. The apostles had the opportunity to know Jesus face to face. They were able to see him and listen to him and hear his teachings and witness his miracles. John speaks to Thomas in John chapter 20 and says to him in verse 29, "Because you have seen me, have you believed? Blessed are those who did not see, yet believed." Therefore, many other signs Jesus also did in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. Here is a promise by one of Jesus' apostles. By reading this book, you can know about what Jesus did. You can know about his words. You can understand what he says. By listening to this book, you can believe in him. You can believe that he is the Christ, the Son of God. And that by believing these things, not only do you gain some type of intellectual power, by believing and obeying and giving your life to Jesus in this way, you can have life in his name. That is an amazing idea. And so we have in our hands something that is absolutely powerful. And even though it has gone through a process of inspiration that I don't understand completely, and goes through a process of transmission where there are some ideas, there are some questions, there are some things about the canonization where there's some question marks about that. And then finally you come to translation. I can't translate it myself. I have to depend on somebody else. But despite all of that, God knows. And God has been watching over the centuries and preserving his word so that even today, as we read this together, we can believe that he, Jesus, is the Christ, the Son of God, and we can have life in his name. That's an amazing promise. That's a promise for you and me. Thank you so much for your time.